In the cleanup spot, it'll be Willie Mays Akins.
6'2", 220. He'll be 26 years old on October 14th. And there are his stats. 20 home runs, 98 runs batted in.
Deep to right field. McBride is going back. This ball may be out of here. Home run, Willie Mays Akins. His second home run of the ball game. And if he's not tired, he's going to be tired after that shot. Willie Mays Akins really into a trot, just now getting to second base.
The 1980 World Series was the highlight in the playing career of Willie Mays Akins. It was also a time in which he encountered his greatest demon. Cocaine use ultimately led to his downfall in the form of multiple prison sentences, the most recent being a 14-year punishment. Since his release in 2008, Akins has reprioritized his life and has bounced back superbly. This roller coaster story is depicted in the book Safe at Home, released in 2012. It's a story that began modestly in rural South Carolina, where, contrary to popular belief, the inspiration for his name did not come from the legendary Giant center fielder.
Nope, I wasn't. That's not even possible because my mom, she wasn't into sports. She never watched baseball as a kid when I was growing up. She only saw me, the first time she saw me playing in sports was in the 1980 World Series. Mm-hmm. Right here in Kansas City, we had three games here, and she came to the three games. But outside of that, my stepfather, he was an alcoholic, so he wasn't into sports. So I was named after my Uncle Willie. From what I hear, there's a doctor in the neighborhood. His last name was Mays. So I guess that's where it came from.
It was just coincidental. Now, your biography, Safe at Home, written by Gregory Jordan, describes many aspects of your life in great and sometimes graphic detail. That would include your upbringing, as you mentioned a little bit of it. How tough were your living conditions growing up in Seneca, South Carolina?
Pretty bad. We basically lived in a shack. We had holes in the floors. You know, you could look through the floors and see the ground. We didn't have any running water in my home until I was about 15 or 16 years old. We used to dip a bucket inside of a well. And we had wood stoves. We had an outhouse, which meant that we didn't have a bathroom or a restroom inside of the house. And I lived in a poverty. But, you know, growing up as a kid, when you could grow up that way and that's all you know, you just have to accept it and deal with it until a better time comes in your life. But one thing I did do was I didn't let that affect my attitude or the way I went about doing my life. I got into sports, and sports kept me out of trouble. And eventually I was able to get a scholarship to go to college and become a professional baseball player.
Now, we hear many athletes who are raised in poor neighborhoods say that their motivation in playing sports is to one day be successful enough to reach the professional level and attain enough wealth to help his or her family. Was that a similar mindset to you as you played football and baseball both in high school and eventually at South Carolina State?
Well, when I signed my contract in 1975 for the California Angels, I got a signing bonus. You know, it wasn't that much. It wasn't like anything what the players get today. Even though I was in the first round, I was the second player picked in the draft. But the first thing I did was I took my mom and I moved her out of the shack and I put her into some new apartment. So the idea of me helping my mom get out of a place like that was a whole purpose basically of becoming a professional athlete. Help my family, and I did.
As you said, the California Angels made you their number one pick. You were the number two overall pick in 1975. Played well enough to reach the major leagues, hit 21 home runs in 1979. But 1979 was the first year that you used cocaine. How did you come across the drugs, and was it an addiction right away?
No, I only used, I think, in 1979, I used cocaine once. I think we was playing the Minnesota Twins in Minnesota, and I was just walking down the hallway in the hotel and happened to go inside of a couple of players' room, and they had some white stuff on the table, and they asked me if I wanted some, so I snorted the line. I basically didn't feel it. I didn't like it. And after that, I really didn't use the drugs. So it didn't become a part of my life until I was traded to the Kansas City Royals in 1980.
And traded to the Kansas City Royals in the offseason between 79 and 80. Got to hit behind future Hall of Famer George Brett during his greatest year, in which he hit 390. You personally benefited from that as the team's starting first baseman. You had 20 homers, a career-high 98 runs batted in. The Royals swept the Yankees in the ALCS, went on to play the Phillies in the World Series, where you were the hitting star for Kansas City, a 400 average, the first player in World Series history with two multi-home run games in the same series, and you had a walk-off single in Game 3, the Royals' first ever World Series victory. How did it feel for you to get hot, really at the perfect time, on such a big stage as the World Series?
Well, a lot of people don't know in September of 1979, I had knee surgery. We was playing here in Kansas City, and I slid into second base, and I tore up my knee. And the Angels went to the playoffs and played against the Baltimore Orioles, and we lost to the Orioles in 5 games. And a lot of people have said if I hadn't got hurt and I would have stayed in the lineup with the Angels, we probably would have beat the Orioles and gone to the World Series. But when I got traded over here, I was coming off an injury. In the first half of 1980, I really struggled. I had a terrible year. Half season in 1980. The fans here in Kansas City, they practically, literally booed me out of the ballpark. And to come back and hit 20 home runs and drive in almost 100 runs was pretty incredible, especially after protecting George and allowing him to hit 390. But we had a pretty good team in 1980. Hal McCray, Amos Otis, George Brett, Willie Wilson, UL Washington. I mean, we had some pretty good hitters on that team. And we had Quisling in the bullpen. Dennis Lillard was one of the starting pitchers. But second half of the baseball season, I played well. And the Kansas City Royals in 76, 77, 78, I think they played the Yankees in the playoffs. And all those years, they was never able to get past the Yankees in the playoffs and go to the World Series. And then all of a sudden, I got traded over to the Kansas City Royals. And I think the third game of the World Series, the third game of the playoffs against the Yankees, I hit a two-run single that allowed us to win the game and go to the World Series. So basically, I think the fans here in Kansas City was as thrilled just to get past the New York Yankees and go to the World Series as they were to get into the World Series.
Look at Maddox toward left center. Right center field is McBride.
Well hit, way back. This is maybe out of here. It is. Look at Willie Mays' ankles. He's just now at first base.
The 1980 series, I think I had such a great series because it was just a carryover from the season to the playoffs to the World Series, and I was hot. And I didn't even know I had made a record in the World Series until after the World Series was over with.
Now, despite your efforts, Philadelphia went on to win the series in 6 games. You continue to be a consistent power threat from the left side of the plate, reaching 23 home runs in 1983. But by the end of that season, you and three teammates, Willie Wilson, Vita Blue, and Jerry Martin, were being questioned by the FBI, and you were sentenced to a year in jail. The first big leaguer to be dealt that punishment eventually served 81 days for a misdemeanor cocaine possession charge. I'm not sure, you probably can't speak for the others, but did you have the mentality before the sentence was placed that since you were an athlete that you were immune to jail time, immune to such a severe punishment? I mean, was it kind of a shock when it went down?
I basically used drugs every game after the World Series in 1980. And in 1981, we met this guy here in Kansas City, so we used to go over to his house and snort cocaine, tell stories, and it just became a part of my social lifestyle, along with some of the other players that played for the Kansas City Royals. I think most big leaguers, you know, we have a lot of stuff that is given to us. I can recall a lot of times here in Kansas City, I would be speeding, and I get stopped by cops. They would recognize who I was, let me off. So it just becomes a pattern in your life that you have that thinking that if something happened to you, you will always be able to get out of it, even though numerous signs, and one of my teammates told me I better stop doing what I was doing or I was going to get in trouble. With that kind of mentality, I just kept doing what I was doing, believing that nothing bad was going to ever happen to me. And it was a grave error in my life because 1983 was my best year in the big leagues. Like you said, I hit 23 home runs, hit over 300. And because of my attitude here in Kansas City, I had a bad relationship with the manager, Dick Houser. When Dick Houser came over in 81, he started platooning me. And I didn't like it because I had been an everyday player. So now I'm basically only playing against right-handers, and I'm not playing against left-handers, and whereas I feel like I should have continued to play every day. So I started coming to the ballpark late. I wouldn't take batting practice or infield. And it was because I would stay up a lot of times at night and be under the influence of drugs. And after we got sent to prison, I got traded to the Blue Jays. I mean, the Kansas City Royals, they didn't want no part of me. They only kept one of the players out of the four players that stayed here in Kansas City and played.
Willie Wilson. And Willie Wilson, correct?
Exactly. So as long as I played well, everything was okay. But I went up to the Blue Jays, and now I'm a part-time player again. I'm only playing against right-handers. And Bobby Cox was the manager. He told me before I got there what my job assignment was going to be. But I ended up missing all the spring training in 1984. And then baseball suspended all of us for 45 days. So I didn't come back to play until May 15th. And now I'm behind everybody, all the pitches and everything, and I never was able to catch up. During the winter, I played winter ball and came back the next year, 1985, and I think I was in the big leagues for about a month and a half, and I got released. But after that, I couldn't find a job here in the big leagues, and I truly believe it was because of my criminal record, and it got around the league that I was a troublemaker here in Kansas City the last year that I played here.
Do you feel your cocaine use harmed your ability to perform on the baseball field?
At that time, I don't, because 1983, I probably used more cocaine in 1983 than I did in 1980, 81, and 82. And I had my best year ever on the baseball field in the big leagues. So I hadn't got to the point whereas it was affecting my performance out on the baseball field, because I would use it nighttime and I would get my rest and come to the ballpark the next day ready to play. Now, I can honestly say later on in my baseball career, when I went to Mexico and I became a smoker instead of a snorter, I believe after playing in Mexico for maybe 3 or 4 years, my last couple of years down in Mexico, I believe that drug use was starting to affect my ability out on the baseball field.
Cocaine use became a real epidemic in Major League Baseball in the 1980s. Aside from your own teammates that used and the public nature of the Pittsburgh drug trials in 1985, was it almost an open secret around the league that this was becoming pervasive, almost to the point of out of control?
I don't know if it got out of control, but I knew somebody on every team that was getting high. And those people, when teams would come here in Kansas City, we would introduce them to the people that we knew that had drugs, and we would just party. And when we travel on the road or whatever, the guy that we knew here in Kansas City, he would follow us. But I think cocaine was the drug of the 80s, like steroids became the drugs of the late 80s and 90s and 2000. I don't believe more than maybe 3 or 4 players on each team was using drugs at that time. But from what I saw, most of the players, they still had control of your life. I don't think your life had become unmanageable or anything like that.
The FBI learned that the cocaine issue in baseball was much bigger than just the locker room deals in Pittsburgh. There was a network of dealers providing cocaine for some of the biggest names in Major League Baseball. During the ensuing trials, baseball fans all over the country heard graphic testimony from a virtual all-star team of players. Dave Parker, Lonnie Smith, and Keith Hernandez, among others, were given immunity from prosecution. In return, they spoke openly in court about not only using cocaine themselves, but named who they did it with and where they got it from. Some even telling stories of buying drugs in ballpark bathroom stalls.
Now, when you went down to play in Mexico, you played very well. I think you almost hit over 40 home runs and had over 400 average. You did continue to use, as you said, you started to smoke cocaine. Was that continued use just a product of addiction, or were there other influences leading you down that path?
Well, my 2 years in Toronto, 84 and 85, I didn't use any drugs. And my first year in Mexico, 1986, I hit 454, which is a record, and I drove in 154 runs, which was a record. I didn't use any drugs. And my second year in Mexico, I played down there for the first month, and I caught hepatitis. And I got real sick, so I had to go home. And one thing that happened to me after my 1986 season is I went to Mazatlan and played in the Winter League. And a team from Japan sent a representative to Mazatlan to sign me to a contract to play over in Japan the next summer. And I negotiated a contract for $300,000. Now, my last year in the big leagues, I had just made $600,000. Now I'm getting ready to go to Japan and make half of that. And I was just 302 there. When it came time for me to get a working visa to enter the country and play in Japan, I wasn't able to get one because of my criminal history. So after that happened, I couldn't get back to the big leagues, and I couldn't go over to Japan and play, and I was going to be stuck in the Bush Leagues of Mexico. I made a decision in my life that if I wanted to have a drink once in a while in my social life, well then I was going to drink. So I started back drinking. And my drinking led back to my drug of choice. So before I knew it, before 1988, when I went back to Mexico, I was back to drinking and drugging again. But there was a period of time from when I left the Kansas City Royals and played in Mexico, like three and a half years, that I was clean and sober.
In 1994, you were caught selling crack cocaine to an undercover Kansas City cop 4 times. The quantity exchange made it a felony and subject to mandatory minimum sentencing. The judge eventually sentenced you to 20 years and 8 months in jail. Do you feel you were set up in that situation, and do you feel the penalties were too harsh?
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that I was set up. I mean, I was getting high here at my home in Kansas City, and I had a little incident that happened in the Kansas City Police Department. They started watching me for about 2 weeks, and they couldn't find anything going on. So eventually they sent this undercover officer to my house, who was a female. I was trying to get in the pants, and eventually she asked me to get drugs for her, and I did. And she was an undercover officer, and I didn't know that. But they allowed me to break the law 4 times. To get a certain amount of cocaine in order that I would fall upon a certain guideline, which was a mandatory minimum 10-year sentence. They offered me a plea deal. I didn't accept it. I went to trial and lost, and I received a sentence of 20 years and 8 months. And it devastated me. Now I'm at a point in my life, I don't know what to do. But from my thinking at the beginning, I felt like I was entrapped. I felt like I was set up. But after doing 14 years in prison and doing an inventory of my life, you know, I look at it as the Kansas City Police Department looked at it as punishment for me. But with my spiritual life, I look at it as a blessing. Because if I'm not set up and if I'm not taken out of this situation, you know, the ends of drug abuse and alcoholism are always the same. You end up going to an institution, you end up going to jail like I did, or you end up dead. And more than likely for me, I had $500,000 in the bank. I had no plans of stopping what I was doing. So I probably would have ended up dead. So going to prison for me was a blessing in disguise.
What did you not learn from your initial period in jail that you learned from your second turn in prison beginning in 1994? What was different this time around? Because usually, you know, just if you go to jail once, you kind of, it's like a jolt, like, okay, you know, I'll never do this again. What was different the second time?
Well, the biggest difference from me now in my life, it was my spiritual life. But I think the number one change that I had to make and realize was that I had a problem. I mean, when I first went to prison playing for the Kansas City Royals, I was inside of a rehab center before I went to prison. I was in total denial. I never believed that I had a problem. And I didn't think that my life was unmanageable or anything like that. But I guess the second time when I received the sentence of 20 years and 8 months, and I finally started developing a relationship with my little girls who were 5 and 6 at the time, became a better father while I was incarcerated, I was able to get my priorities in order. And I took some rehabilitation programs while I was incarcerated. And I finally realized that the undercover officer, she wasn't the foundation of my problem. You know, it's the fact that if she don't come to my house with it, I'm not set up. But if I'm not sitting at my house using drugs and doing what I was doing, but then it doesn't make any difference if the undercover officer comes to my house or not. I don't do drugs for her. But I wasn't able to start working on myself until I accepted responsibility for what I had done and finally realized that, hey, I was the person that had the problem, and I can only control and work on Willie Akins. I can't control and work on anybody else. And that was the first thing that I had to admit to myself, that I did have a problem. And after I finally admitted that, I was able to forgive the undercover officer for what she had done. I was able to become a family man while I was incarcerated. And I was able to grow it spiritually while I was in prison.
Is it true Hal McCray was the only former teammate that contacted you while you were in jail?
Yeah, and you know, I wrote to my other teammates mainly because I was filing for clemency, which is a commutation of sentence with the president. I was trying to get my sentence reduced. And I wrote to some of my other teammates, and I never heard anything from them. Hal was the only person that responded, but I understood the situation behind those guys not responding to my letters. You know, I was the one that was in prison, and a lot of times, or even most of the time, when a person goes to prison and you are incarcerated for a long period of time, your family abandoned you. The people that you think or thought were your friends, they abandoned you. And I experienced it while I was incarcerated, and I saw other people experience it too. I just knew that these guys, they didn't owe me anything, and I didn't hold it against them when I got out of prison, because when I got out, you know, I was able to contact George and get in contact with him. But yes, Hal McCray was the only one that I heard anything from.
And that proved to be a worthwhile connection, because he helped you get a job right out of leaving prison, correct, in construction?
No, Hal McCray was the person that had a contact in Blue Springs. When I got out of prison, I talked to Hal, and Hal asked me if Linda Taylor, the person that owned the construction company, had been in contact with me, and I said no. So when Hal played here in Kansas City, he lived right beside Linda Taylor, and she owned the Rims Construction Company. And he said, Willie, you take this number. I've already talked to Linda. You call her up, and I think she might have a job for you. And I called Linda up, and I talked to Linda, and she hired me. And getting out of prison, I was making, as a laborer, like $25 an hour, which was a tremendous blessing for me, because at the time, I was staying at the halfway house, and I had spent every penny I had on my daughters while I was in prison. So Hal McCray is the one that put me in contact with the person that owned the construction company.
Okay. And also, upon getting out of jail in 2008, one of the first people to contact you, as you said, was George Brett, who before, as I've read, didn't answer your letters from prison. But he reached out and asked you to speak at his son's middle school. He then convinced Royals general manager Dayton Moore to bring you back as to the club as a guest instructor, which you took, of course. How important was it for you to not just have another former teammate reach out to you, but for it to be someone of the stature of George Brett?
It was a miracle, really. I mean, when I played for the Royals, and we used to go on road trips, And they would talk about the Kansas City Royals coming into town. They didn't say the Kansas City Royals were coming into town. They would say George Brett and the Kansas City Royals. So basically, George Brett was bigger than the Kansas City Royals. And to be able to contact George, and George asked me to go to the summer school and speak, and still have that friendship with George after being incarcerated for 14 years, I mean, the only way I can look at that was a blessing. I didn't have anything to do with it. I believe that God touched George's heart, and George heard me speak, and he said, Willie, I think you should be back in baseball, and he took me over to meet Dayton. And it didn't happen until a couple of years later, but I truly believe if I don't have that connection with George Brett, I probably wouldn't even be working for the Kansas City Royals right now. But, you know, just to be back in professional baseball, my last year in the big league was 1985. So until 1985, up until 2011, when I signed my contract with the Kansas City Royals, I hadn't been associated with anybody in Major League Baseball for like 36 years, since 1985, well, for 26 years.
So having been around the Royals, did you foresee their turnaround and the ultimate success they've enjoyed the past year?
Well, I was able to see what was going on within the minor league system, and I knew that some of the players that had played in the minor league system and that I had coached that were in the big leagues was the make of a team of greatness. Now, to be honest, did I think the Royals was going to go to the World Series this year? I was just hoping that they make the playoffs. And the way they played throughout the season, especially the first half, I was kind of doubtful if they were going to make the playoffs. But I think with the caliber of players that Dayton Moore has signed and drafted and free agency and all that kind of stuff like that, has the makeup of a tremendous team. And our team is young. And, you know, what those guys did this year was pretty incredible. And I'm just blessed, and I was proud of those guys. And, you know, to be a part of a team that go to the World Series, because I was a player that played in the World Series, and I know how important and how much fun it is to the fans here in Kansas City, because I experienced that. And then I got a chance to experience it again last year in 2014. And to have a record in the World Series, you know, every October, my name is mentioned anytime somebody hit a couple of home runs in the World Series, because they always talk about me being the first player to have multiple homers in the World Series. But last year was a thrill for me. I believe that the team for this year, Dick Moore has brought in some players, Morales, Rios, I believe that has improved the offense. Basically, we have the same pitching staff, we have the same defense, and we have the same speed that we had last year. So I look for those guys to have a better year this year than they had last year.
Amid your own life turnaround and recovery, you recently had a recovery of another sort as you retrieved your 1980 American League Championship ring, which had been stolen from your home in 1981. How did you wind up getting that back?
Well, it was pretty incredible. I was just being faithful. I spoke up at Gaslin United Methodist Church on November 2nd. And as I arrived at the church, the pastor let me inside, Pastor Lori Murphy, and she showed me over to the table where I was going to be sitting there signing and selling my book. And she handed me this business card. And she said, Willie, you need to contact this guy. I said, who is it? She said, well, earlier in the day, I was out in the neighborhood passing out flyers to let people know that you were going to be speaking at my church tonight. And I walked in the store across the street, and it was a pawn shop. And I gave the owner a flyer, and the owner looked at the picture, and he asked me if this is the same Willie Aiken that played for the Royals in the 80s. And she said, yeah, he's going to be speaking at my church tonight. Why don't you come and hear his testimony? And the owner of the pawn shop told her, we just finished talking about that guy as you walked in the door. And he says, give Willie my business card and have Willie to call me and tell Willie that I have him, that I have his World Series ring. And while she's standing there telling me that story, I couldn't believe it. Because about 5 hours earlier in the same day, I was out at the Chiefs game promoting my book in the parking lot with the tailgaters. And I ran into some guy who started telling me a story about my World Series ring. He said he had been at a party, and this guy had my ring. And I'm like, well, where's he at? He said, I don't know. It happened a couple years ago. And I said, well, my ring got stolen in 1981, and I haven't seen it since. And so I'm talking about it at the Chief game. I go up to this church to share my testimony, and the pastor has the business card to the owner of a pawn shop who has my ring. So the next day I go over to the pawn shop, and I walk in, and I ask the guy, and I didn't tell him who I was, if they had any World Series rings or not. And he said, I think we have one. My brother has it in the safe at home, and it belongs to Willie Akins. And he said, let me go over and get my brother, and you can talk to him. So he go over and get his brother, and his brother come back, and his brother asked me, are you Willie Akins? I said, yes, I am. He said, Willie, I got your ring. I said, well, how much do you want for it? He said, well, I want $2,500 for it. He said, I've had your ring for the past 20 years inside of the safe. I said, that's pretty incredible. He said, some guy walked in one day, showed me this ring, and it was yours. And I asked him, how did he get it? And he said, you pawned your ring for drugs. And at that period of time, I was incarcerated. So to use that kind of story, it basically connected my ring to the drugs. So I tell a guy I'll be in contact with him at a later date. I go out to my car, I get ready to leave, and I'm brainstorming about what I can do. So I decided to sign one of my books and give it to him free, hoping that later on in the future, when I call this guy back or come see him, that he'll give me a deal on my ring. So I leave. So I start adding this part, this episode of my life, to my testimony whenever I speak. And I have this friend, her name is Kim. So one day I'm telling Kim this story, and she's like, Willie, you have to get your ring back. I said, Kim, I'll get it back eventually. And she said, look, if you don't have the money, I'll loan it to you. I said, no, you don't have to do that. The guy has a ring, and he said he's going to hold it for me. So 2 weeks before Christmas, Kim called me up and asked me the name of the church where I spoke at on November 2nd. I told her, but I didn't put two and two together, that she was trying to find the pawn shop. So on Christmas Eve, Kim called me up and told me, Willie, I got a present for you. Can you meet me at this restaurant? She said, it's a present that you are going to like and your family will like too. I said, okay. I met Kim at the restaurant. She gave me a little paper bag, reached my hand inside, take it out, and it's my World Series ring. Absolutely incredible. And I'm like, Kim, I can't believe you did this. You paid $2,500 for my ring? And she was like, no. I was able to negotiate with the guy, and I told this guy this story that my mom had passed away 2 weeks before Christmas, and my mom told me to do a good deed for somebody this holiday season. And she said when my mom told her that she thought about me and getting my World Series ring back for me, and she said, Merry Christmas, Willie.
The latest heartwarming chapter in a fascinating life story. We're very happy to have had Willie Akins on to tell it. Thanks for listening to Baseball As It Was.
Akins, a red-hot hitter. He won the game last night, now hitting .462. He also had a triple scored. Had two home runs in Philadelphia. Hit a two-run homer in the first inning. Akins with 17 total bases, leading all hitters. 7 runs batted in. Well hit, deep.